God would give me some sign. If he would just speak to me once. Anything, one sentence, two words. If he would just cough.
Of course there's a God. We're made in his image.
You think I was made in God's image? Take a look at me. You think he wears glasses?
Not with those frames.
Despite humorists like Woody Allen, the question of God's existence is no laughing matter. From law to morality to our own eternal existence, everything crumbles with God out of the picture. Discover why this week on Just Thinking with author and apologist Ravi Zacharias. On April 8, 1966, Time magazine bore a cover with the question, "Is God dead?" in bold red text on a black background. 40 years later, many are asking that same question, and a lot of those aren't just asking if God is dead, they're living like God is dead. This week on Just Thinking, we're broadcasting a fascinating series by Ravi Zacharias that was originally delivered at Harvard University. Let's listen in as he dismantles the philosophy of atheism in his message, "Is Atheism Dead? Is God Alive?"
I recall many years ago, as a teenager, trying to do some reading in my living room in New Delhi, India, and completely surprised to listen to the words of a song that was being narrated with a kind of an Eastern chant in the background. And it was being very clearly spoken out. The words were under the refrain of the chorus, "Who will answer?" And Ed Ames was the narrator, and this is the way the words went. He said, "From the canyons of the mind, we wander on and stumble blind, way through the often tangled maze of starless nights and sunless days, hoping for some kind of clue, a road to lead us to the truth. But who will answer? Side by side, two people stand, together vowing hand in hand, that love's embedded in their hearts, but soon an empty feeling starts to overwhelm their hollow lives, and if they ask the hows and whys, who will answer? Far upon a distant hill, a young man's lying very still, his arms will never hold his child because a bullet running wild has struck him down, and now he cries, 'My God, oh why, and who will answer?' As high upon a lonely ledge, a figure teeters near the edge, while jeering crowds collect below to egg him on with 'Go, man, go,' and none will ask what led him to his private day of doom, and who will answer? As 'neath the spreading mushroom tree, the world revolves with apathy, while overhead a row of specks roars on, drowned out by discotheques, and if the secret button's pressed because one man has been outguessed, who will answer?" And then this verse: "Is our hope in walnut shells worn round the neck with temple bells, or deep within some cloistered walls where hooded figures spray in shawls, or high upon some dusty shelves, or in the stars or in ourselves? Who will answer?" And the chorus goes, "If the soul is darkened by a fear it cannot name, if the mind is baffled when the rules don't fit the game, who will answer? Who will answer? Who will answer?" It may not be the most prestigious, the most appropriate place in which to make such a statement as this, but here in the Harvard Law School building, it was Andrew Fletcher who once said, "Let me write the songs of a nation. I don't care who writes its laws." Now, isn't it interesting to you, and as it is interesting to me, that with all of the innovations we have, all of the knowledge into which we are immersed, all the facilities to which we have access in our time at the tail end of the 20th century, the songs in effect have not changed. The questions still remain the same. And Camus said it a few decades ago, the fundamental question about life is meaning. Anything else is secondary. And until that question of meaning is dealt with, he says, I really care not for what the answers are to the other queries. Muhammad Ali was reputed to be flying in a plane once. His name is synonymous with many things. Humility is not one of them. And while he was flying on this plane, it hit moderate turbulence. For those of you who fly, you're aware of the fact that when the pilot tells you it's moderate, that is a euphemism for, if you have any religious feelings, now's the time to start expressing them. Because mild is all I can endure. And the flight attendant came over, had ordered or had announced that all of the passengers needed to fasten their seatbelts. Everyone complied except Ali. She walked over to him while the plane was bouncing around and said, "Excuse me, sir, would you please fasten your seatbelt?" To which he promptly replied, "Superman don't need no seatbelt." She didn't miss a beat and said to him, "Superman don't need no airplane either." In many ways, assuming ourselves to be super people, somehow having conquered some known mountains in our time, we have assumed we do not need the security or the seatbelt of this fundamental question. And I believe it was Will Durant who said, this is the greatest question of our time, the existence of God or the absence of his existence. As one who has lectured and taught in philosophy in various parts of the globe, I believe all philosophy ultimately either is born out of or is built upon these two foundational questions. Number one, does God exist? And number two, if he does, what is his nature? What is his character? Now, obviously, dear friends, there are many, many levels at which this can be answered, and you are here with your own presuppositions and your own views. One of the struggles that I personally have, having been transplanted from the East to the West, and having seen what religious anger and intolerance can do in some parts of the world, and having seen what ideologies can do, albeit atheistic, in other parts of the world, and let us not forget that. One of the most troubling aspects to me as one who is trying to wrestle with these issues is born out of a concern why it is not possible to disagree without being disagreeable. Why it is not possible to discuss these issues without generating more heat than light. Is it not important to deal with these fundamental issues in a reasonable manner? There are many good minds coming from different perspectives. When I was studying at Cambridge University, my professor of philosophy was Don Cupid. Don Cupid happens to be an ordained priest, but is also an atheist. He has written a book called The Sea of Faith, amongst many other books, and someone has appropriately called it Faith at Sea. Because if you don't like what Don Cupid believes, come back the next semester. He may have changed it in the process of his own mystical growth. But in that same institution is Brian Heblethwaite, a brilliant philosopher, who in response to Don Cupid's book, The Sea of Faith, has written an outstanding book in defense of theism called The Ocean of Truth. You can read the debates between the brilliant mind of Bertrand Russell and the counter perspective of the Jesuit philosopher Frederick Copleston. You can come right down into the scene here and look at the battle in the same issue between Kai Nielsen from Canada, one of the most prolific writers in the field of atheism, and J.P. Moreland, the fine Christian philosopher teaching in California. And their book, Does God Exist?, is probably one of the finest in its genre, well critiqued by Dallas Willard of USC and Peter Kreft here right out of Boston. Or you can look at two colleagues teaching right at Cambridge, Stephen Hawking, in its avowed agnosticism, and the counter perspective from John Polkinghorne, the quantum physicist. I happen to take some courses under Polkinghorne, listen to Hawking through his speech synthesizer and so on. Both of them coming from two completely different perspectives, Polkinghorne a deeply committed Christian, and Hawking, as I said, an agnostic. There are good minds on both sides of the debate, and therefore at least one thing we need to contend with, that this problem is not merely intellectual, for intellectuals have come to it from different perspectives. Now, I have a little grid in my own mind when I teach philosophy or even talk to my children, and that is this. You don't have to endorse it wholeheartedly, but in a popular level, I think you can identify with it. Philosophy, or my belief system, basically comes to me in one of three possible ways. Level one is what I call theory. And if you're dealing with theoretical philosophy, you're dealing with the classical philosophers like Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, or you're going to some of the great Enlightenment thinkers like Hume and Kant and so on, you're dealing with arguments at a highly theoretical level, albeit very vital and important in an academic pursuit. But let's face it, most human beings will never crack open a book by Socrates or Plato or Aristotle and have no particular interest on Kant's view of ethics. How do most people today really come to their belief systems? What about your friends and my friends, or your children and my children? I believe today they come to their belief systems by an invasion of the imagination through the arts, which is a second level in philosophy. One of the reasons that existentialism gained such a strong foothold in many parts of the world, particularly in Europe, and captured the imagination of the university students of the 60s and 70s, whether it was Sartre or Camus or so on, it was because they came to the thinking process through the avenue of the arts. And you can go in to see a play on Broadway, or you can turn to many a movie or listen to music, and you will find a certain philosophy of life is either being endorsed, espoused, or questioned. And the popular mind today comes to philosophy not from a theoretical superstructure, but it comes to it from an infrastructure of the arts. And level three philosophy is sheer prescriptivism. You sit around the kitchen table and your teenager comes home from school and says, "You know, Dad, today we were discussing such and such an ethical view in class. Some people said it was right and some people said it was wrong. What do you think?" And if the person happens to be a professing Christian or someone, he says, "Well, son, you know, we believe what the Bible says, and in such and such a book, in such and such a chapter, this is what it says about such and such a behavior." And the son is looking utterly perplexed at his dad. He is dying to say it, but may not say it. What he's dying to say is, "You know, Dad, the Bible works very well around our kitchen table because the structure here is plausible for such pontification or prescription. But what you think is your strongest argument, Dad, if I were to go into the school tomorrow and quote what you've just quoted to me, I'd be laughed out of the classroom as having presented the least effective argument of them all." It's sheer prescriptivism. And if you want to know what prescriptivism is, listen to the talk show hosts who will pontificate on ice cream parlors and sexuality and the origin of the universe with equal sense of distancing of their emotions from any one of those issues. "This is what I believe, so must you also."
With that quote, we conclude day one of Ravi Zacharias's message. Is atheism dead? Is God alive? Today's presentation was originally delivered at the Harvard Veritas Forum. It's one of two messages shared in that groundbreaking event, and the entire package, along with an engaging Q&A, is available in its entirety. If you've ever wondered whether the Christian faith can stand up against atheism, we invite you to order a copy when you call us at 1-800-448-6766. Our number again is 1-800-448-6766. Be sure to ask for the Harvard Veritas Forum when you call. For more resources, visit us online at rzim.org. Just Thinking is a listener-supported radio presentation of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Finally, join us again tomorrow as Ravi continues his message, "Is Atheism Dead? Is God Alive?" Until then, keep thinking.